Yes, we found her. The first person in the world to have her voice broadcast by radio.
Not quite that old, but thank you. Hey, welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkwe Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Welcome to Tuesday. Hope you enjoyed the weekend. I got a chance to see the biggest film on the planet. Yeah, Gone Girl. If you read the Gillian Flynn novel, it's very true to it. You're going to like it. We'll talk a bit more. Also, pay homage to three luminaries we lost in just the last couple of days. Here we go again. SCOTUS making eye-raising decision regarding same-sex marriage. We'll talk about that. Get you in the mix, too, if you're listening live on Tuesday, October 7th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed already getting busy at AB Writes. The show today brought to you in part by the Lincoln Motor Company. It's the perfect blend of style, luxury, and tradition. Live in your moment. Ride with the Lincoln Motor Company. And by the new improved PopNet, it's arts, culture, conversation, 24/7 online, on the air. It's the new improved PopNet. Speaking of conversations, our guest today certainly has started a phenomenal conversation about race relations and the legacy of slavery in this country. Chris Tomlinson is the noted former AP reporter who has covered such perilous places as Africa, Iraq, and Afghanistan. He's currently a staffer at the Houston Chronicle and the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Tomlinson Hill. There's also a companion film. I've only seen the trailer, but it's fascinating. It's the story of two remarkable families, both sharing the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. Chris, who is a fifth-generation Texan and a descendant of slave owners, comes from the white end of the family, and he explores the legacy of slavery and what it's done to his generation, the white family, as well as the black family that kept the Tomlinson name after emancipation. It's a fascinating read and an important one, and we thank you so much, Chris, for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Amy Beth.
It's a pleasure. Talk to us about this project. I know it's something which has been intriguing you and maybe bothering you since you were a child, right? The legacy that knowing that your family, and you've known this since you were a child, at some point your ancestors were slave owners, and the legacy that this kind of hangs over your current generation and how people react to it and live with it and deal with it. How did you decide to go forward with this book?
Well, I grew up hearing stories about my family owning slaves, and this was particularly troubling to me as a 7 or 8 year old child at a time when Dallas was desegregating schools and race relations was one of the hottest topics in the early 1970s. As an adult, though, I went to cover the end of apartheid in South Africa, where I witnessed a culture coming to terms with its legacy of racism. And then I went to Rwanda and covered the end of the genocide that was based on bigotry and hatred. And in the process, I realized that, you know, I'd never really faced the reality of what my ancestors had done. And as a country, we really haven't had the kind of Truth and Reconciliation Commission that South Africa has had or that Rwanda had through the traditional court system. And so my book is a chance or an opportunity or an attempt to have that kind of truth and reconciliation, if only for my family.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting because it always percolates every now and then. I mean, you see things like the Ferguson, Missouri, all these different things that we haven't really dealt with it, and it keeps popping up. You think, and a lot of people like to say, oh, it's over. You know, we have President Obama, so racism is over, and those kinds of things where, like, they're Band-Aids on this wound that really hasn't healed and maybe never will. But certainly talking about it and exposing it on different levels is one way to get it started. And you have a fascinating, you know, project. It was quite an undertaking because you kind of explored your own family that you're familiar with, and then you went out and found the black Tomlinson family as well. How long did this take you? Because it's quite an undertaking.
Well, working part-time, it took me 7 years to trace both families, white and black, to study each one of them, to read 100 years' worth of newspapers for the small town of Marlin, which was near the slave plantation called Tomlinson Hill. You know, I had a head start partially because the most famous Tomlinson of all is a black man named LaDainian Tomlinson, who was a running back with the San Diego Chargers, future Hall of Famer, and he spent much of his childhood on the same land where my family held his ancestors as slaves.
Fascinating. And so your conversations, did you have conversations with him?
Yes, LaDainian wrote the foreword to the book. His family was extremely gracious and helpful in helping tell that side of the family story. And I, you know, did my best to make sure that I treated everyone the same, whether living or dead, black or white. And I tried to use my foreign correspondent's kind of harsh glare to try to really understand what happened. Because as a country, we talk about race every day, but we don't want to face up to our history of racism and be have an honest conversation about what our ancestors did or did not do.
So what did you think? What did you learn in this process about what your family did and how that affected you, and also the black side of the family, or the black family that kept the name?
Well, growing up in the South, in Dallas, a former headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, I realized that my grandfather was most likely a Klansman, a part of that movement. I learned that despite what they tell us, taught us in school, there is no such thing as a good slaveholder. And that much of what I had learned about our country's history with race was sanitized and told in the passive voice as if no one was responsible. And I came to realize that, you know, my family actually had a lot to do with the oppression of the black Tomlinsons, denying them the opportunity to go to school, to go to college, to have economic opportunity, even to move away and try to find a better life off the cotton plantation.
So what was the legacy for you in terms of, do you feel like you have some reconciliation now that you've uncovered this and explored it and written about it? And what about your own family? Have they reacted positively to it? Or were they upset with you for undertaking it, or relieved that you wouldn't? I mean, what was their reaction to it?
Well, my grandparents had passed away many years ago. My father was the one who broke the chain of racism in my family and raised me to open my eyes and examine this history honestly, and he was very encouraging. I think I needed to understand that I possessed a lot of privileges because of the color of my skin, even though I grew up relatively lower middle class and poor. I realized that I had to make an apology, not for what my ancestors did, but for the pride that I took in my family's so-called aristocracy by virtue of holding slaves. And I think, you know, while I don't expect anyone to apologize for what their ancestors did, I think we owe everyone in our culture a recognition of what they did. And that's what I think is lacking, particularly when you start having debates about what happened in Ferguson and in other parts of the country.
Well, that's interesting. So what are you saying? You're saying that people, because they're denying what happened, that spills over into things like the Ferguson incident and the way African Americans are still treated today and that sort of thing? Is that what you're trying to get at?
Yes, I think white and black America have fundamentally different ideas about the history of this country since the Civil War. And I saw that, you know, in South Africa, where you had perpetrators and victims sitting down in the same room and telling their stories, in the Gacaca courts in Rwanda, where you had the same process, where everyone got to have their say and there was an honest and complete accounting for what happened, that's what enabled those cultures to move on. The reason why we can't seem to move on is because we haven't had that accounting of our past.
That's so interesting. That's so profound. You're right, I think, because we try to band-aid it. We try to say, I think white people get very defensive, and we say things like, oh, it's over, just get over it, and black people, why are you holding on to this? You know, that kind of thing, deflecting it onto the black population. And as you said, they have a very different, that legacy is still there, and until you acknowledge it, you can't overcome it. But you said earlier in our discussion here that you had kind of a mixed feeling. Like you, even though your father broke the chain of racism and wanted you to explore this, you said you still had some pride in the family as a younger person, right? That they had this.
Right, and that was the split between my father and my grandfather. I mean, my grandfather had grown up with this pride of being a Texan who could trace his heritage back to 1849, who had helped establish culture in Central Texas as we know it today, of building the roads and building the plantations and building the wealth that made Texas what it is today. People don't realize that Texas still made more money from cotton than it has from either oil or cattle when you adjust for, you know, cost of living and inflation and that sort of thing. So that was his view, was that, you know, the whites built something great and everyone else was inferior, whereas my father was the one who stood up and said, you know what, no, that's racist, that's wrong. And so I got both messages and I mixed them up in my head, and it wasn't until I was an adult and looked at this that I could completely comprehend what was going on.
Well, it's good that you're honest about it, too, because I think that's the key. Like you said, if you have to have the honest discussion and the complications that come with that, especially for people who can trace their... As you said, I mean, you have nothing to do with having slaves. I mean, you were born long after it was all over, but the fact that your family was involved in it, it probably weighs heavier on you than it would on somebody else who may not have. And I know everybody, those of us who come from European... You know, immigrants later on will say, well, we had nothing to do with it, but still, it's a legacy in our country that we really have to own up to. What are you hoping that this book is going to start? And I guess it already has started, because a lot of people have given it some great buzz about it, this conversation, and you also have a companion film, which I think looks very intriguing. I've only seen the trailer of it, but what is your hope for this project?
Well, the conceit of the book and the film really is to... Let's boil it down to two families. Let's not talk about blacks and whites or African Americans or European Americans. Let's look at two families with the same name coming from the same place, and let's look at what they experienced. What opportunities were they given? What opportunities were they denied? You know, when I look at the school that my father went to in 1950 and compare it to the school that LaDainian Tomlinson's father went to as a sharecropper in 1950, you know, that's not so long ago, you know, and that clearly has an effect on who I am today and who LaDainian is. You know, I had the opportunity to meet a woman who knew her grandfather who was born into slavery. That's how far, you know, it's not that long ago. And that continuity, I think, helps demonstrate why what happens 50 years ago or 100 years ago is still important today. And that was what I was trying to do with the book, is make that point.
What were some of the surprises? Were there things that surprised you that you learned about either or both sides of the family? Or families, I should say.
Well, two things. Is one, that the African-American Tomlinsons were quick to absolve me of any responsibility. And one of the things they would often say is, well, it's what your ancestors did, and your ancestors didn't know any better. Well, when I read the newspapers and I read what they read, I realized that they did know better, that there's always been an intense debate about the rights and wrongs of slavery and that economic system, and that there was never a period in which someone said it was universally accepted that slavery was good and the right thing to do. So that surprised me on both of those counts. I also didn't realize the level of self-sufficiency the black community resorted to in the face of Jim Crow. They established these things called freedom colonies that were places where they, you know, set up schools and churches. And they went from like 30% literacy to 90% literacy between 1870 and 1900. So there's all this stuff that I did not learn that is deeply fascinating. And I hope people who read the book will enjoy that.
So you were surprised, you expected not to be forgiven as easily or, you know, absolved of any guilt from the black side of the family?
I expected more hostility. You know, I expected a certain amount of resentment at the privileges that I had that they didn't have as a result of the system that my family helped impose. So it wasn't there. And, you know, now...
What do you attribute that generosity of spirit on their part? Is it because they managed to succeed in spite of slavery, or is it just that's who they were, I mean, who they are?
To a certain degree, I think it's who they are. Also, I think part of that had to be won, frankly, over time. You know, I can say that, you know, LeVar and Londria and many of the black Tomlinsons, I consider family now. They consider me family. We're in touch all the time. We talk about what's happening between our families. But I had to show that I was ready to face the truth. and that I was ready to be honest about what happened and have a complete idea of what was involved. And I think by doing that, I earned their trust, and they found it to accept, found it within them to accept me and accept my project. And that's the kind of reconciliation that I think is possible when you have that accounting of the past.
Why do you think, in your exploration and maybe, you know, also in your self-reflection, why do you think other people, other white people in particular, are so reluctant to engage in that kind of conversation? And I know we certainly have done shows around things like Ferguson, Missouri, and the George Zimmerman trial, where you have some white people are just very reluctant to even discuss race anymore. They want it to be just over and done with, this notion, the legacy of slavery and racism, when it clearly isn't. And I just don't know why they're so reluctant to acknowledge it. And even for people, and not everybody has necessarily, were descended from slave owners, but still it's something, it's sort of our national albatross that I believe you're right. If we don't address it, it's always going to keep percolating and it's always going to keep popping up. But what do you think, in talking with white people, why do you think they're so reluctant, or some of them are so reluctant to come to the table and actually have that accounting?
Well, I think there are three things. One, you know, I would point out that slaveholders did not have a monopoly on racism in the 19th century, so racism was across the board. Even if you believe slavery was wrong, you were probably still deeply racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's wrong. I think it's hard for people to admit that their ancestors were wrong. We don't like to speak ill of the dead. We like to honor them. And so in addressing this and facing up to what our ancestors were really like rather than what we want them to have been like is very difficult. And I know I had that trouble. I mean, I wanted my family to be different. I wanted them to be more heroes and less villains. But, you know, that's not the way it worked out. I think the next thing is that it's this American idea that we all pull ourselves up from our bootstraps, that we're not from a classist society where we inherit privileges, and so even though factually and financially we can show that people inherit privilege in this country, we don't like to admit it. And that's one of the reasons why we deny that what our ancestors did had any effect on us. And finally, there's shame. I mean, I think I think it's shameful to have to admit that you are privileged because your ancestors committed what would now be considered a crime against humanity. And overcoming that shame and instead embracing the truth is a way to know how to live our lives today is the right thing to do. But you have to put that shame away and think, you know what, that's what my ancestors did. I can learn from their mistakes, and I can move forward with my life and live my life better because my ancestors made those mistakes. And that's a hard step to take.
It's a big step, yeah. And, of course, you need to take just, you know, ignoring it and, you know, sweeping it under the rug or saying it's old news. I think that's kind of the thing that people use as the way, the smokescreen, to avoid discussing it or, you know, copping to what the legacy really is in this country, is to just say, oh, it's over and done with, stop talking about it.
Well, that's easy, right? I mean, it's easy to say, well, we fixed that in 1965, or we fixed that in 1952 or 1865. Pick any big event in the history of civil rights, and you can say, oh, well, it was solved with that. That also allows us to blame the victim for where they're at and not have to admit that our ancestors were the ones who actually did wrong. You know, and so it's that transference of guilt from our ancestors, from our family, onto other people that is also very convenient. It's very easy to do, and it's not nearly as challenging emotionally or intellectually.
Right. But, I mean, you don't have to blame yourself if you're acknowledging what your ancestor did or just acknowledging what the legacy of this country, and there are, you know, you can love America and still acknowledge that there are some atrocities that were committed here throughout our history and still be honest about it. I mean, I know there's some, there have been stories in the news about some schools that want to scrub the history books even more and only show positive things and don't want to show any kind of civil disobedience. I think there's a case in Colorado you might be familiar with that just seems so crazy to me. It's like, you know, people want to know the truth, and people should have the right to know the truth, and the truth is not always cheerful. It's not always great. It's not always nice, but you want to know the truth so you can learn from it, I think, and just have that discussion.
Well, and I think,
what's your response? Yeah, sir.
No, I was just going to say, in Texas, there was a move to change the name of the slave trade to the triangle trade in textbooks as a way to try to, again, sanitize that history. I think there is a conservative movement to try to fight multiculturalism, to try to fight relativism, and part of that involves sanitizing our history and saying that our ancestors did nothing wrong and that we need to follow in their tradition, and that comes down to the culture wars, which is, you know, certainly a very important part of this.
Yeah, for sure, and you're right in the thick of it with this project. This, I say project because it's the book and it's the movie as well. What made you want to do both? Did you decide you wanted to just have, you know, two sides of it, or it just, which came first? The book came first, I'm guessing, and then you decided to make the companion film. Is that right, or no?
Well, I started working on the book, and a old friend of mine is a filmmaker, and she started following me with a video camera as I was doing my interviews and doing my exploration, and we realized that there was an opportunity to do a film about present-day Marlon and present-day Tomlinson Hill to address how people are living and still trying to overcome this legacy of the legacy of slavery. And then the book, obviously, is this 160-year epic that is more concerned with these two families rather than the larger community. And so we thought it layered well, and that so you could see the film and read the book and get a more complete picture of what's happening in America.
Yeah, very fascinating. It really is. It's an important story. Or stories, and it's an ongoing story. I think the film, as you said, does bring it into the present day and what is happening now. Where do you see it now? I mean, you obviously you've gotten some great buzz on both, I'm guessing. I haven't seen the film yet. Is that going to be in wide release or available on cable, or how is that going to play out right now?
Well, the film's available on Vimeo. It was shown on PBS stations last summer. We hit about 85% of the country. We're hoping the station managers will choose to air it again for Black History Month in February, so we're going to make a push then. And so hopefully, and it's also, the DVD is available online. I'm beginning to speak now at college campuses and starting this conversation about, you know, how... Now, what is our history, and how does it affect us today?
How is your reception on college campuses? Are people eager to hear this? Do they want to get involved in it in an interactive sort of way, or is it more passive? What's the tone for you?
Well, I've been surprised that of all the public events I've done, including readings, people have been amazingly encouraging. I haven't received any hate mail. I haven't received any complaints. I think one bad review on Amazon accusing me of being a revisionist. I think we're excited. I think it's an exciting time. I think we're in a place now where, as a country and as a culture, we're ready to have this conversation. It's a little discouraging when I realize how little history the college kids know, that, you know, when I teach them about, you know, when I talk about Jim Crow and I talk about the Klan, and, you know, that 60% of the white men in Dallas, Texas were members of the Klan in the 1920s, that they don't know any of this, and they don't realize what a huge distance we've come as a country and as a society. Which is not to say that we still have a long way to go, but it's a chance to kind of remind people that, you know, change is possible and lasting change is possible.
And as we have all these growing pains and as the culture is changing and becoming more multicultural, we also see the pushback with the conservative movement trying to push back, like the voting rights and those sorts of things, which is discouraging and must be discouraging to you to see that kind of thing happen. Where, as you said, you know, 50 years ago we had the Voting Rights Act, and now all of a sudden a lot of these states and the Republicans are trying to make it harder for people to vote because they know they can't win legitimately by the numbers. They just have to repress the vote, and that, is, to me, is such a, regardless of how you want to vote, that as an American is so disheartening and really unconscionable, because it's about everybody having a stake in the democracy. And if you can't win with your ideas, you know, you shouldn't be repressing people from getting out there and voting. What do you feel discouraged when you realize something like that?
Well, I, as a foreign correspondent, covered 9 wars, and every, you know, ranging from South Africa, Rwanda, Afghanistan, Iraq, and, you know, a half dozen in between. And in every one of those conflicts, there was an element of bigotry. And it could be as stark as the color of your skin, such as in South Africa, or it could be as minute as your sub-clan affiliation in Somalia. You know, people were discriminated against in Somalia, the most ethnically homogenous place on the planet. People discriminate against you based on who your cousin is. So when you tear away the bigotry and the racism, you begin to realize this is all about power and privilege and trying to either hold on to it or take it. And so when I see things like the fight against the Voting Rights Act and other voter suppression measures, I'm just reminded this really isn't about race. This is about power, and it's about political power, and it's about economic privilege. And so what you're seeing is distinctly human, and it's the one thing that we have to learn to deal with. And to say that it's only about race is a shortcut, you know. But as I said, that's based on 9 wars where people, at the end of the day, you know, were finding excuses to hate each other in order to grab power.
Yeah, well, that's true. A power grab for sure, because the idea that you see the power slipping away, how do you hang on to it? But it is, you know, because we are based on, even though an unfortunate number of people don't vote, you know, a large number of people don't vote, especially in the midterm elections, on the off years, so-called off-year elections, it is sort of a tenet of our society. And as you covered, a lot of these places that don't have rights like that, or maybe started to fight for rights like that, and if they attain them, then people do vote in droves. It's still just something that's very uncomfortable, I think, for me. But yes, you're right, it is a power grab, and a lot of it is not just, you're right, to make all these shortcuts is just as bad as when people make excuses for why do we have to talk about it at all. You know, I think that you're very right about that. It's a fascinating topic. It's one that we're not likely to lose any time, and I think it is a legacy that we're going to have to bear. And even if we have the accounting on a grander scale, which doesn't seem, I mean, you're encouraged by in small groups, and every small, you know, group or every person talking about it is one step closer, but it doesn't seem like we're going to be on any grand scale talking about it, I don't think, anytime soon. But even if we did, I think it's because it is really a big part of our history that we have to accept. So it's not just copying to it, it's also accepting it. And as you said, accepting the good and the bad, whatever you find from your family and from your country. It's, you know, to whitewash it, to sanitize it, I don't think is the answer.
Well, to whitewash history or to sanitize it is to not deny ourselves the lessons of it, and that's how we're going to commit the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah. We're doing some of that. But on the positive side, somebody like you coming along with this story and these stories and putting it forth to people and getting a great reaction is certainly a great step in the right direction. So I commend you for that. Congratulations. Talk to us before you go, because we have a lot of people who listen in who are aspiring writers or writers, and they're always interested in the juggling act. And you certainly had, you said you worked on this for over 7 years part-time. In between your foreign correspondent gigs, or were you already at the Houston Chronicle when you were working on it? I mean, how did you do the juggling act? Because this is a pretty big book, and you had a pretty big day job, so to speak.
Well, my day job didn't offer much opportunities to work on this project. So, you know, frankly, I spent every weekend working on the book. I'm not the kind of person who can work as a reporter and a writer for 8 hours and then go home and spend another 2 or 3 hours writing and reporting, or at least not doing it well. And so it was my vacation days. It was my holidays. It was my weekends. I haven't had, you know, more than a 3-day vacation in 5 years. So it's a it's hard work, and yeah. And I wouldn't recommend doing a book about American history and the history of two families spanning 160 years. It's over 400 pages.
It's a big undertaking,
you know,
for sure. Yeah.
It was not a good choice for a first book, but. But, you know, it's also a deeply personal book, and that's the thing as a writer and any publisher or agent will tell you is that you have to be the right person to write the book. And in this case, it worked for me, and so for that it's very satisfying. But it's a part-time job. It really is. And I would tell any writer who sets off to do this that this is your startup. It's your side project. It's the one that, you know, it's the one that's going to feel like a lot of work, and it'll be worth it when you're finished.
Yeah, you have to want to do it. You have to be called to do it, as you obviously clearly were. This is something which was something, a story, stories that you wanted to tell since you were a child, even if you didn't know it when you were a child, because you were intrigued by it, you asked questions, and it stayed with you, and you were compelled to follow it through. Otherwise, you wouldn't have done it, because, as you said, it's a lot of hard work. So if you didn't give up on it, you knew it was something you had to do, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. It certainly was worth the effort and worth the wait. Tomlinson Hill is the book. Chris Tomlinson is the author, and there's also the companion film. Do you have a website where people can just go and find all the information about you?
Absolutely. TomlinsonHill.com. You can find out about the book, the film, and we've posted segments of a lot of the interviews. So you can watch the interviews in full on an interactive site that will also show you around Marlin, Texas, and Tomlinson Hill.
Oh, fabulous. Very intriguing. I'm going to take a look at that today. Chris, thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you the best.
Thank you, Amy Beth. Thanks for having me on the show.
Take care. It's a pleasure. That's Chris Tomlinson. Find out more at TomlinsonHill.com. It is the Amber Tharkley Show. Reach out via Twitter at AB Writes or on the studio line if you're listening live, 347-857-4505.
Somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them. You see, it's in the blood. Both kids are good and bound. Blood's thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
American family affairs. Fly in the Family Stone on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Thanks going out to Chris Tomlinson again, the author of that very intriguing, important book, Tomlinson Hill, and the companion film. Details at the website, tomlinsonhill.com. I'm looking forward to those interactive videos as well. On the Twitter feed, Colin says, fascinating story. I look forward to reading it. Thanks. Great interview, too. Well, thank you, Colin. And Marcy says, yeah, great interview. Enjoy the discussion, a very important one we all need to have. Cop to it, America. All right. Thank you. See, we're getting some more readers. I like it. Again, find out more at tomlinsonhill.com. So what else is on your mind? Reach out via Twitter at AB Writes or on the studio line, 347-857-4505. Had the chance to see Gone Girl over the weekend. It is the number one movie in America. I think it took in $38 million opening weekend. Wow. It is intriguing. It is creepy. It is very true to the Gillian Flynn novel. She wrote the screenplay, and she, David Fincher kept to it quite well. Rosamund Pike plays Amy Dunn. Ooh. Okay. That's all I'll say. Go watch it. Go read the book, and then we'll talk. I very rarely see the number one film because it's usually some action blockbuster, but there you have it. People are captivated. Well, looking forward also to seeing the Stephen King adaptation of the Stephen King book, A Good Marriage, with Joan Allen and Anthony LaPaglia, I believe. Kind of along the same lines. Troubled marriage with psychopathic overtones. Fascinating stuff indeed. I do want to note the passing of a couple of greats. I just found out this morning Marion Seldes passed away. Oh, the great Broadway legend. She was 86 years old. She was a big Broadway stalwart, breaking. She broke Guinness record, by the way, for a 4-year run in Death Trap without a single missed performance. She won a Tony Award in 1967 for her role in A Delicate Balance. And she was a long-standing teacher at Juilliard with a luminary list of students, including Viola Davis, Kevin Spacey, Kevin Kline, Christopher Reeve, Patti LuPone, and Robin Williams. Marion Seldes, really phenomenal. She was very much closely associated with Edward Albee following her work on A Delicate Balance. She became the playwright's go-to actress, working with him on the play about the baby, Tiny Alice, Counting the Ways, and Three Tall Women. A Delicate Balance, by the way, is getting a revival on Broadway this year with Glenn Close, and I'm looking forward to that. She was really an interesting woman. And she had some movie roles and TV roles, too. Her last appearance on Broadway was in Terrence McNally's 2007 play Deuce. Film work included Truman, Home Alone 3, and TV shows like Murphy Brown and Sex in the City. Marion Seldes, a New York and Broadway legend. She was born and raised in Manhattan by the writer and critic Gilbert Seldes and her socialite wife Alice Wadhams Hall. She studied at the Neighborhood Playhouse with Sanford Meisner and also studied dance with Martha Graham. She is one of a kind. She certainly was. Great work from Marion Seldes. And Jeffrey Holder passed away. He was I didn't realize he was 84 years old, a very buoyant, bountiful, multi-talented song and dance man, choreographer, and, of course, the pitch man from the Uncola, the 7-Up, the old 7-Up ads. He died at the age of 84, so we're losing a bunch again. And Paul Revere, the front man for the 60s band Paul Revere and the Raiders, passed away over the weekend at the age of 76. His birth name was actually Paul Revere Dick, according to the biography of the Internet Movie Database. And, you know, they donned back in the 60s. They tried all that stuff, you know, showmanship with the Revolutionary Garb and all of that. He was born in Nebraska. He played in bands in Idaho and Oregon. According to a tribute on the band's website written by Roger Hart, who managed the group in the early days, Hart said that he took the band to Hollywood and signed them to a deal with CBS Columbia Records. The band had a bunch of hits in the 60s and early 70s. Including Hungry and one of the few first anti-drug songs in 1966. This one's called Kicks. Paul Revere and the Raiders. I'm Amy Beth Arkley Show.
When you come back down, girl, still ain't feeling right. Don't it seem like it's
Their early, circa 1966, anti-drug anthem, Kix, as we remember rocker Paul Revere, who passed away over the weekend at the age of 76. It is the Abby Beth Berkley Show. Reach out via Twitter at Abby Writes. A couple of folks chiming in about our Chris Tomlinson interview. Oski says, fabulous interview. You have a way with your guests. The book sounds intriguing. Well, thank you very much, Oski. Check it out. I think you'll enjoy it. And Susie says, yeah, that is an interesting topic and one that we need to talk about. All right. Thank you, Susie. And Dean says, chiming in about Marianne Seldes, oh, so sorry to hear about it. She is a legend and was a fabulous actress indeed. And some of that work is captured on a film for sure. And I'm sure some of the Broadway productions were probably preserved for tape, although I can't guarantee that, but I bet they are. But what a wonderful actress she was indeed. It is the Abby Beth Berkley Show on a Tuesday. I want to give a quick shout-out from her Inspiration to Action Challenge. This one goes out to Dolores, who I'm not sure where Dolores lives, but she's working on a memoir, she says. The challenge got me focused, firm, and more optimistic And I think I'm raring to go and ready to do it. Well, thank you, Dolores. I hope so. Please keep us posted. Hey, if the Inspiration to Action Challenge has helped you, please reach out to the website. I'd love to give you a well-deserved shout-out. I also think it helps spur other folks on. Reach out via the website, amybetharkaway.com. If, on the other hand, you need a little cajoling, let's have a creativity coaching and or counseling conversation. The first one is always on me. And also, while you're at the website, you can delve into the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, are available for both ebook and paperback. And you can also stop by if you want to be a guest on the show. You know, we're always looking for compelling storytellers, from authors to filmmakers, musicians to theater folks, social commentators, justice experts. You know who you are. Get on the Media Bites award-winning podcast that they call an empowering, entertaining tour de force. We do our darndest, and we'd love you to be a part of it. So reach out, and we'll see what we can do. Trudy is busy with the big book, so I think we're pretty filled up most October, November. But you know what? We have some slots. We'll get you on. Sometimes it's about a timely topic and what we can get into the mix. But we try to, you know, jazz it up a little bit, change it around. Always intriguing folks that we have, and we have some great people in the offing. So be part of it. And speaking of being part of things, don't forget, it's not only your right, it's also your duty to get out there and vote, even in the midterms. If you don't believe me, give a listen to the Capital Steps.
You love watching C-SPAN, but wish someone would put it all to music. Well, just in time for the midterm election, it's a new album. Let's hear a cut from House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Here in the House, fall term's begun. What are the odds we'll get something done? Things still are strange. We've had no luck. I start to cry, but my face is stuck. Obamacare's been rough. But nothing to compare. In Congress, we are dealing with John Boehner Care. Speaker of the House, twisting every arm. Kinda like Newt Gingrich, but without the charm. Pinned right to the mat, fighting Democrats. Getting things through Congress is like herding cats. Who cares if the budget's busted? We all keep our jobs somehow. When the Congress goes to work, the public always gets the twerk. But I won't be a jerk if you'll let me be the Speaker of the House. But it's not just the lower body. Nancy Pelosi also sings along with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. The nation was in sync, but Boehner took it all away as fast as you can blink. Obama's second term has hope, but every move he makes, the GOP just slows us down by pumping on the brakes. Oh, voters, give us one more chance
to show you that we love you.
Won't you please vote D back in the House?
Pelosi.
I wash that spray can off for good.
I want you back.
And just when you thought the midterm couldn't get any more exciting, here comes Joe Biden with a plan to save the Senate.
Hey, you know, this is just crazy. We're going to have to make an appeal to the voters because we make a great team.
I've got the legal expertise.
And I can unite House Democrats.
And I am here too. There ain't no good in our goodbye.
Liberals gotta keep on trying.
Crying.
Let's hang on. to what we've got. Though you know we have not done squat.
Gotta show the right for meanness.
Hang on, hang on, hang on to what we've got.
They say they're gonna make the Senate flip. Gonna take it back from Harry's iron grip.
Take it back.
Who cares how bad the debt
is? Take it back.
We hope you'll just forget it. There isn't anything we wouldn't do. Give gay immigrants a bag of cash or two.
Lean in left.
The nation stands behind
lean
us.
Lean in left.
Failures, please don't remind us. Maybe.
Don't say no.
Maybe.
Take it slow.
As the leader, I'll say it.
Let's hang on. The planet's hot. What's at stake? Well, it's quite a lot.
Let's put fun back in dysfunction.
Hang on, hang on, hang on for one more shot.
Get your copy today. Warning may cause voter apathy.
I love those Capital Steps and Midterm Madness on the Amy Bethurkwi Show. Get out there and vote. You just never know. Looks like the Senate will go back to the Republicans, or at least that's what the predictions are. But you never know. I hear Alison Lundgren Grimes in Kentucky is actually, there was one poll where she was actually ahead of Mitch McConnell, and that would be a big upset. Unlikely, of course, but we'll see. And, of course, if the Republicans do take both the House and the Senate, we'll have just more obstruction for the next couple of years. And will that be a good thing for Hillary and the Democrats? Because if you're fed up with the Democrats and, say, give it to the Republicans now and they still don't do anything positive, will you then be ready to give it back to the Democrats? We'll see what happens. But speaking of poor President Obama, Leon Panetta, the former defense secretary and CIA director and longtime Clinton stalwart, is out with a new book and new criticisms of President Obama, calling him a complainer and someone who's not engaged enough. Good idea, bad idea, really bad form, I think. It's not the first person to do this. I think former Secretary, Defense Secretary Gates did it. Scott McClellan did it against George Bush. So sometimes they do it while the person's still in office. I think even, I heard Paul Begala on CNN this morning saying that George Stephanopoulos did it too while Clinton was still in office. I think it's probably better form to put your book out after the guy or a gal is out of office, although that probably won't sell as many books. But I don't know. What do you think about that? I mean, it's a free country. We have a right to say what we want. It's open discourse in the democracy. I get that. But he's got a lot on his plate. Enough headaches, that's for sure. And apparently very easy access, too easy access to the White House with this, or the Secret Service scandal and all of that. But something yesterday happened that I think was kind of surprising for a lot of folks. This ruling, or non-ruling, as it were, on same-sex marriage in the Supreme Court, they refused, by a 5-4 decision, I believe, to hear appeals on the same-sex marriage bans in various states. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, was the deciding vote on the conservative side. He is conservative, but he also is someone who sees the forest for the trees, if you know what I mean. He sees this issue as one in which the conservative end of the court is on the wrong side of history. Gay rights has moved faster and take bigger leaps than any other civil rights movement. I mean, they took a long time to get there, but once it started moving, it really propelled in a very quick fashion. There are gay Republicans and conservatives, actually. And the younger generation of people, regardless of their political affiliation or religious affiliation, are really for accepting it and seeing nothing wrong with it. And again, things change as generations, and we move through the generations, and you just sort of age out of the old prejudices and old ideas. And they just sort of change and evolve over time, and that's where we're going with gay rights. So he sees where we're headed, and now people can get married in, I guess, over 30 states, is that right? So if you're a gay couple and you've always wanted to get married and you live in a state that didn't allow it before, like Virginia, I think they had their first marriage the minute they announced it, go for it. Enjoy. And it's a big boon to the wedding planning business, too, I suspect, right? More people. They get more people because less people are getting married in general, heterosexual marriages, so we have a new group of people to pull from. It's fascinating as we move forward. And you can move forward. You can also move back if you're a Mad Men fan. Oh, I love that show. So politically incorrect, but so great. So great. And certainly about a particular era in American culture. They're wrapping up their seasons, the bifurcated seventh season. We'll have the last seven episodes this coming spring. And in the meantime, the producers are looking for your fan videos. They're kind of put together a documentary promo featuring fan videos. So if you have something funny or provocative to say about your favorite Mad Men character, do it. You got until Friday, I think, to do it. So I will post a link for you, all you little budding videographers out there, where you can send it in, and you might even win a little small stipend, honorarium, if you are chosen. So good luck to you, Mad Men. Can't wait to see it again. That is one of the favorite shows of mine. How about you? We talked about some favorite shows. What else are you watching? Are you watching anything good? I like Madam Secretary. I finally caught up with that one with Tia Leone. I'm watching it on demand because Sunday nights is just an abomination over on CBS because their football always bleeds into the lineup. And I'm generally watching over on PBS anyway, but it's a good show. I think it's very good. It's told well. It's created by Barbara Hall, who created Judging Amy. She's got a good sense of story and pacing and characters, and I think it's good. So catch that one. You get some international and national, you know, intrigue, but also some good character development so far. So good. Like the Viola Davis show so far, How to Get Away with Murder, very intriguing. Catching up on Parenthood. It's their farewell season, so I'm liking that. And, of course, Nashville. Ooh, that is getting juicy, and I'm really digging that, too. Speaking of Nashville, here's one of Nashville's favorite sons singing about a favorite Texas city, as we were talking about Texas before. It's Buddy Jewel and Abilene. I'm from Austin.
She said her mind was made up as she put on her makeup, said there was nothing here for her. She just packed up her suitcase, she walked right out that front gate with her taxi waiting at the curb. Too many empty nights alone, too late I realized it's a crying shame it took her tears to open up my eyes. I should have seen Abilene on her mind. Her leaving me and Tennessee far behind. Should have seen her grow. I sang a song I wrote about her. You could feel the sadness in the air. And after the show was over, I felt a hand there on my shoulder. Turned around and found her standing there. She said, after all these years, it's nice to know your dreams came true. And the wedding band there on her hand told me that hers had to. Well, I should have seen Abilene on her mind. Her leaving me at Tennessee far behind.
Oh man, I love this song.
Missed my alarm clock ringing, woke up telephone screaming, boss man singing his same old song. Rose been late about an hour, no cup of coffee, no shower, walk of shame with two different shoes on.
TomlinsonHill.com. On the Twitter feed, thanks for checking in, Shay, one of our Hardier regulars. Another fabulous interview. Sounds like a fascinating, impressive guy. I'll check out the book. Thanks, AB. Well, thank you, Shay. And Johnny Fever's Hangover, love the show. Missed part of the interview. We'll catch it on podcast. Great idea and a great reminder. Don't forget, if you do miss the show or want to hear it again, they're all archived for podcast over at the Blog Talk Radio site. Follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show there. Download episodes at iTunes, NetNow, or at the website, AmyBethArkowitz.com. So, you're raring to go? You want to play in the leaves? It's the time of the season with a very October-sounding group, The Zombies.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In the time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands
to take you in this time to
promised land,
to show you everyone. It's the time of the season for love.
What's your name?
Your daddy. Who's
your daddy?
He rich.
Is he rich like me? Has he taken any time?
To show you what you need to live. Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why.
I really.
What's your name?
What's your name?
Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy?
Here is. Is he rich like me? Has he taken?
Has he taken
any time?
Any time
to show? To show you what you need to live.
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you.
Five on the Amy Beth Arkley Show, and a very autumnal sound of time of the season from the Zombies. Hey, thanks going out to our Twitter feed. I love it when you guys play with us in real time. Always appreciate it. Don't forget to friend me on Facebook. Follow us 24/7 for the conversation at Twitter at AB Writes. Chris Tomlinson, thank you so much. TomlinsonHill.com is the website. Fascinating book and movie for sure. Find out more there. Thanks going out to the TCS crew, Trudy, Aurora, ML at headquarters. Friday, it's our free-for-all featuring a robust recap of the cultural sideshow, music, and more. And a visit from Karen Bunnell, the co-author of the Co-Parenting Handbook, looking to raise a child in the midst of divorce who's well-adjusted and on their way to a bright future. She'll help you avoid some traps. That's all coming up on Friday's show. So there you have it. And thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget to drive safe, play nice, dream big. Love to see you again on the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Take care.
all your people.